Thank you, Mr. Pavlik, and good afternoon. Nope, still good morning. I'm getting in shape for next week when we go back to 2:30. So good morning to you all, or I'm just speaking to our friends in St. John's, where it is already afternoon, 12:30 or so in St. John's, 12:35. At any rate, it does look different. The last 8 weeks here, I've been looking out, as Mr. Patchinger said, at four people and a camera. Well, the camera is still there, and it's still not blinking, but it's good to see a few more faces out there looking back at me, that's for sure. Most of us that were not involved at that moment in the service, we could stand behind the monitor here and look at the lyrics on the screen. That's what you're all doing, sitting right there in the middle, aren't you? I see. Cheating. You can look at the monitor. So we'd wander around back there and make faces at the song leader. No, we didn't do that. but at any rate, it is good to see people warming the seats again and be back. It looks like we have, I'm guessing we have 2/3 to 3/4 of the congregation here today, which is, I think, quite good for the first time back. I am looking forward to some of those super holy days that Mr. Pavlik was talking about too. I'm sure we all are. And when Mr. Patchinger said in his sermonette, he made the reference from Revelation 19, the reference to Christ's return. Excuse me just for a moment here. About Jesus Christ's return to the Mount of Olives, I had to step back for a minute and think for just one moment. Last year, on the Sabbath before Pentecost, my wife and I were standing on the Mount of Olives. It was our tour of Israel, and that was the Sabbath morning. We actually went up to the Mount of Olives and had a Bible study on the mountain, Sabbath morning just before Pentecost. And somehow I got dragged into doing that one, but it was just a remarkable opportunity. Mr. David Johnson had asked me to do that and to speak on Pentecost, which I very much appreciated. I don't know when the next time that I'll be able to speak in Jerusalem on Pentecost is, but I'm looking forward to it. It'll certainly be a super holy day for sure. Have you heard the term writer's block? I see by the expressions out there that some of you have more than just heard of it. Some of you have experienced it, I'm sure. I recall one of my earliest experiences in school was in the 7th grade when there was an essay assignment that was due for history class the next day. Now maybe you're thinking, what a mean teacher he had to assign an essay that was due the next day. I have to be honest and admit that it had actually been assigned for several days, possibly up to a week or more, before I was sitting in my house, staring at a blank piece of paper on the kitchen table, wondering what I would write about. My procrastination was the problem, not the teacher's approach. You know, sometimes a pastor gets a bit of sermon block, too. It may not be so much that he can't think of anything to talk about. After all, this is a rather big book. But sometimes it's more, what would be the most helpful subject for this week's message? What is it that it seems, from talking with people, sometimes visiting with people, calls you receive, trends you see around us, what would be the most helpful thing to talk about? What would be the right topic or a right topic for this week? That's not always quite so obvious. I was working this week earlier on about 2 or 3 different ideas, which is not uncommon, jotting down some thoughts, setting them aside, trying to find the scraps of paper later. No, that's a little more organized than that, but not much. Coming back and looking again, jotting a few more notes down. at least one of the ideas just wouldn't gel. Now, that sometimes happens. I see Mr. Patchinger nodding, so he's had the experience. It just didn't seem to fall into place the right way. Then yesterday morning, we had a cover letter sent to all the elders on a document from McKinney headquarters. It was a cover letter by Mr. Doug Horchak, who's the operations manager for ministerial services, on the most recent edition of a monthly publication for the ministry called the Ministerial Newsletter. We hadn't actually received one since February. Generally, it comes out every month, and I guess I was just not noticing with everything else that's been going on that we hadn't had one for about 3 months. But we've also been having weekly electronic updates during this coronavirus pandemic. Those weekly updates have now stopped. Wednesday was the last one, the final one Mr. Franks was mentioning, and we had another newsletter sent by electronic transmission yesterday. Mr. Horchak's letter was enthusiastic and encouraging. He wrote that the staff at McKinney were happy. He used that word. He said, happy to be sending us this first newsletter in 3 months and planned to resume the monthly publication. It included with it a new feature that goes to the wives of the ministry called Between Friends that Mrs. Tanya Horchak has been working with a crew and a group. This particular issue had articles by Mrs. Judy Servideo and my wife to the ladies of the ministry, the wives of the ministry. It was the second issue to come out. Then my wife and I listened last night to this week's One Accord presentation, also presented by Mr. Horchak. In Accord. One Accord is the publication. I saw my wife making noises at me, and Matt Pavlik was smiling broadly, so I knew I'd said something wrong. Luke was making faces at me too, so. But the presenter was Mr. Horchak. His tone was the same. Even though he was passing on some challenging bits of information, and if you've watched it, you know what I'm talking about, like the criteria that we'll have to use in trying to determine the plans for the remaining youth camps for the summer. I was talking with one of our camp directors, Mr. Paul Carter, in California the other day, just yesterday, I believe, and he was telling me about some of the things they've been using to try to decide. But the question is, if we have to take all of those things into account, will we still be able to have a camp in the same manner that we're used to and what it means to our young people? That's the question they have to decide. In addition to, of course, some states may not even allow it yet. Pennsylvania has been a little bit more restrictive in that regard in some ways than other states, and of course that's where Camp Heritage is, so we're just not sure yet for how things will work out. We'll have to see. Time will tell. He was also talking about similar planning, that looking ahead to the Feast of Tabernacles, and I also had a chance to talk with John Pinelli. Mr. Pinelli is the one who coordinates all the feast sites in the western half of the continent, and he was telling me some similar concerns. Right now, for example, where we're assigned to go this year in Victoria, the province of British Columbia has restrictions in place, at least unless it's changed, through September of only allowing 50 people in one meeting hall. We have 242 registered for Victoria. Like Mr. Pinelli says, do you want to be able to tell people they can go to two services during the feast? I said, no, that's your job. That's why they pay you the big bucks. So we'll see. But then Mr. Horchak mentioned something similar last night, that we may come to a situation where we will attend the feast and we'll be able to attend some of the services in person, and we'll have to just watch the others on webcast in the location where we are. That's not the way we're used to keeping a feast. But it's preferable to not having one, for certain. And of course, as he said, then afterwards, whatever other activities are planned for the rest of the day should be able to be engaged in. We just don't know in certain ways. Will we need to have crowd size restrictions in place? That's something we have to look at. Will we only be able to attend, let's say, half the services in person and watch the others by webcast? Many years ago, when I was a feast coordinator in Canada, we had a year when we expected an overflow crowd for the auditorium we were using, and it was a conference center, a convention center. It was a center of the arts. They had their orchestra play there in the city, And there was a large convention hall downstairs. And so that was able to be used for an overflow crowd. And I was the feast coordinator there, and I was talking with the manager, and I said, you know, this is going to be a little difficult because we're having an overflow crowd this year. We can't fit everybody in the auditorium. We'll have to have some people downstairs in the overflow hall every day. I was saying, I wonder how we'll do that. She says, simple. She says, your people follow instructions. You just tell them, on this day, this church area, and this church area, and this church area, you sit downstairs. The next day, this church area, this, and I said, well, duh. Now, why didn't I think of that? But she was familiar enough with the church people that she knew that would work. It ties into what Mr. Patchinger was talking about today in terms of working to get along and respect. We don't yet know all the details. But as I read Mr. Horchak's letter, and as I watched him last night, he was enthusiastic, he was encouraging, he was even happy. And he gave us an idea why. We know God's plan. Another of his annual holy days is approaching tomorrow, this Sunday, Pentecost, the anniversary of the founding. And yes, that's exactly right, Mr. Patchinger, 1,989 years ago. The founding of God's New Testament church. I'd thought of Pentecost too, but I admit that there was a point when I was tempted to compare Pentecost 2019 with Pentecost 2020. Pentecost 2019 in Jerusalem, Olive Tree Hotel. Pentecost 2020, Johnson's family room in front of a television, two people. And I thought, you know, that's really probably not the best way to look at it. That's a tough comparison. But as I listened, I realized why I was feeling a bit blocked in getting this week's sermon together. Oh, I had some notes, and some of them I've been able to incorporate into this sermon today. Others are still sitting there waiting for use. Maybe they'll blossom one of these weeks into something helpful, something of value to you, God's people listening now. But they weren't working for today's sermon. My wife knew about my dilemma. I told her about it. After In Accord was over, she looked across the room at me and she said what I was already thinking. She said, maybe that's the kind of thing that works best for tomorrow. And she was right. I'll say it louder. She was right. It's true. Last year we were in Jerusalem for Pentecost. This year, another exotic location. Not so much. But Pentecost still means the same thing it did last year. And under the circumstances, there is certainly something to be grateful for in that we are beginning to return to in-person services, at least in this country. The last time all of us met in this hall, all of us that are here now, was March the 7th. That's quite a while ago. Now, I see a handful of faces that look real familiar. In fact, the one right behind the camera here looks really familiar because I've been looking at him every week for the last 8 weeks. But we're grateful, I hope, that we've had that. I'm grateful, and I hope you are too, for the fact that we can once again begin to meet together. Some of our brethren around the world are too. In New Zealand, for example, they're able to meet. I think they even started last week, but outside the United States, the May 30th date wasn't quite the same. Malawi never stopped meeting, as we've heard. But in New Zealand, they've actually had discharged from the hospital the last COVID-19 patient in the country. Now, of course, they're not letting anybody in either. In fact, I think that our pastor for the area, Mr. Von Belkum, is there, but Tim and Valerie Waddle are still stuck in this country, not able to get back in. That's where they live, but they were visiting family here when everything locked down. They're still not able to get back home. So there are reasons for it happening. Today, though early in the week, I admit it was not exactly in the forefront of my thinking, I want to talk about gratitude. Gratitude. Yes, last year, the day before Pentecost, we were standing on the Mount of Olives. That was a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Only we hope it isn't once in a lifetime, but it may turn out to be that way, and if so, it was wonderful. But it won't be once in a lifetime in the grand scheme of things, if you know what I mean. In this country, and a few others, perhaps, some countries have different approaches in thanking God. We even have national holidays. Maybe we think of those things as we approach the fourth Thursday of November in the United States, but I hope that's we realize that's limiting it way too much, way too much. What are some of the things you and I are grateful for at this point in our lives? It's easy to see what things might be troubling, too many things. But what about gratitude for some very basic things? How about we begin to list just a few? Number one, acknowledging God in our lives. When I say acknowledging, that takes in quite a wide range of territory. Of course, that's basically where the idea for that national holiday came from. I'm sure most of us know the story of the pilgrims and the first hard winter and so on. But how about we plug some of these points in, points of gratitude, into where we are right now? Right now. For example, while these are trying times, and we have had at least one death, to my knowledge, in the church, a member from COVID-19, of which I'm aware, a lady in New York City some weeks back, the actual incidences of illness have been very few, all things considered. We know, of course, of relatives of members who have been affected. And we know now, more recently, of 10 members in the Santiago, Chile congregation, a large congregation of about 350, 10 members who have COVID-19. But they're all at home, expecting to recover fully. Will there be others? That's possible. As things begin to open up more and people move around more, traveling is resuming at a slowly increasing pace. Last time I checked, the TSA pass-through figures, that is those who go through the TSA checkpoints and airports in this country, were up to now somewhere between 10 and 13% of the average number of travelers this time a year ago, but it had dropped to less than 4%. So gradually it's creeping up. I was talking to a gentleman yesterday, and he was saying that he was talking to an acquaintance who was a flight attendant, and she was telling him that on her last flight as a flight attendant between here and Chicago, there were 60 people on the plane. And it must have been a fairly sizable plane because they're blocking off middle seats and so on, but that's she had told him just a few weeks ago it was like 8, you know, or 6 or whatever on the flight. So some things are starting to move again. As that happens, will there be more exposure? Probably. Will it change the gratitude that we owe our merciful Father for the marvelous plan that we are to be reminded of tomorrow on the anniversary of the founding of the New Testament church? Of course not. Nothing changes the plan. One thing we want to be sure of is that we begin to resume our regular Sabbath services and fellowship with unity and gratitude and appreciation. What we don't want to do is to bring in the divisions this pandemic has made even worse in the world around us. And I'm sure we've all noticed that. It's just gotten more strident, more polarized, more difficult. That would be too close to repeating the example of our ancient forebears, the Israelites. Take a look back in Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 1. You know the basis of Deuteronomy, that Moses essentially is repeating the story of the travels of Israel before his death and before Joshua takes over. He says, "Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe. that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, he allowed you to hunger, and he fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. Your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. We walked around the Holy Land for 8 days last year, and everybody's feet swelled. So that's kind of remarkable. You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Eternal your God chastens you. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you've eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he's given you. Beware that you do not forget the Eternal your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. That was the point. As the Israelites were essentially on the border of the promised land, a message from God through his servant Moses, with reflective points for humans of any era, including us, to think about. Some points of this may not seem to exactly fit. After all, God speaks of multitudes of blessings they were looking forward to going into the promised land. Well, we have multitudes of blessings in this land too. But we also know that there are some difficult times ahead in prophecy. But despite the current conditions, right now, can we focus on the many blessings? How easy, brethren, is it to forget? We know that ancient Israel wrote the book on quickly forgetting. This pandemic has impacted us now for what? About 3 months. I know it feels like Mr. Henderson was talking about in his meme a couple of weeks ago, where he talked about this leap year being so different. You know, a leap year that February has 29 days, March had 31, and April had 500. Yeah, there's something in that. It has felt long. It's felt a long time since we've been here in services. Except for the cameraman and one or two or three others, for which I am grateful. But brethren, how easy can we forget? Does that put it into perspective? It does for me. At least I want to be sure that it does. You know, that same nation of Israel moved into the promised land and they began to write their history. But by the time of Samuel, one of God's remarkable servants, they began to lose sight of some of those words that Moses had told them. And in 1 Samuel chapter 8, it says in verse 1, "It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They took bribes. They perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you're old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us." Notice the phrase, "like all the nations." What were they looking to? But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Eternal, and he said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you. Samuel, you have not failed me. But they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they've done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also." Basically, God says, "Welcome to my world, Samuel." What does that feel like? He said, "I know the feeling. I know the feeling." So he was told to go ahead, let them have what they ask for, but with the warning, the proviso, that he was to tell them what the king they were asking for would be like. And you can read about that from verses 9 to 18. I won't do that right now. And that was pretty accurate, because basically Samuel could say, "Look, you want a king like all the nations? How about checking a little current history, current events? Look at those other kings and take a look at what it's like. What makes you think your king will be any different?" Now he had the chance to be. Kings were told to read the book of the law. Some of them did pretty well. Most of them not so much. Notice the people's response in verses 19 and 20. "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" All of which God had promised to do. But they said, "No, we want to be like the world around us." So sad and so short-sighted. Brethren, you and I know that we can't go there. Nor should we want to. We must acknowledge God and give Him the thanks He so richly deserves. And in this case, acknowledge means to put Him in His proper place, which is first. First place in loving and obeying Him and in imitating His mind and character. And that's something to be grateful for. Something else to think about in this context of what we should be like, then let's just say it, being a grateful person. Being a grateful person. Are you a glass half full or a glass half empty kind of person? Well, I think we would all rather be the glass half full, but sometimes it's tough. It certainly ties in. I once read an editorial online written by a chief executive of a philanthropic corporation, and he pointed out a rather valuable principle he had seen in his workings with his foundation. He said he had noticed that it seemed to him that those who seemed to be grateful people in general struck him as being happier and just generally better off than anybody else. Now, it wasn't exactly a scientific process, but he was just, it's kind of anecdotal, but he said it really struck him as a pattern that those who were just by nature more grateful seemed like they were happier and better off. And we'd say, well, that makes sense. He actually wrote this in one of his editorials. "Some people see their lives filled with abundant blessings and find thankfulness easy and natural. Others are so preoccupied with tending to past wounds or current crises that they simply don't feel grateful." And in his case, he said, he noticed the ones who could be grateful were happier. They just seemed to be better off. He said, the platitudes are true. The key to happiness is deciding to be happy. It's not getting more than you have. It's appreciating what you already have. And then he finished off this editorial by saying, so whether things are going well or poorly, open up a new emotional bank account and start filling it up with all the things that deserve your gratitude. If you do, I think you will find you have even more to be grateful for. And I think those are wise words. Turn to Proverbs chapter 15. Let's look at a few Proverbs that actually seem to back up what this man discovered. Now, his whole approach, of course, he was running a philanthropic foundation. It was a foundation dedicated to helping people. So you can imagine that he tried to staff it with people who took that approach. And that's a good thing. Proverbs 15 and verse 13, it says, a merry heart makes a cheerful countenance, but by sorrow of the heart, the spirit is broken. That's quite a contrast. A merry heart makes a cheerful countenance, but by sorrow of the heart, the spirit is broken. Now, I'm sure we've all had moments in our lives both ways. But which one's more enjoyable? Which one would you rather be in? I think we'd rather have the cheerful countenance. And I'm sure we would rather have people around us who had cheerful countenances. That much we can say for certain. What kind of a heart, a mental outlook do you and I have? Doesn't that affect the way you see life itself? It's a little bit like the story, you know, of the little boy who went into a stable and he saw a pile of stuff that gathers in stables when it's not, you know, cleared out once in a while. And he got a shovel and he just started digging and the stuff was flying every which way. And somebody said, what are you doing? He said, with all that in here, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. Well, you know, that's a good way to look at it, isn't it? Wouldn't you rather be looking for the pony than complaining about what the pony left behind? How about Proverbs 15, verse 15? Oh, by the way, this one, 15:13, is basically repeated in chapter 17, in verse 22. It says, a merry heart does good like medicine, a broken spirit dries the bones. But in chapter 15, right where we are, and verse 15, here's the contrast. All the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. Is it really true that somebody who's going through bad times, every single day of life is evil? That's kind of pushing it a bit, don't you think? Some days are hard. Some days are harder than others. But is it also a little bit hard to fathom that somebody who's of a merry heart has a continual feast? Is life a continual feast? Well, realistically, no. But what's our outlook? What's our outlook? Do we still have things to be grateful for? Is this a commentary on a person's actual condition or more on the mindset that views that life situation? Gratitude for what we have, resentment at what we're missing. Which is it? I don't mean to imply that life is always rosy or that no one ever has any problems. That would be foolish. We know that these days. But what's our general outlook and approach? Proverbs 16, verse 23 says, the heart of the wise teaches his mouth and adds learning to his lips. Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the bones. And immediately look at the verse that follows it. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Which do we want, brethren? I know we have the same answer. Proverbs 17, verses 27 and 28. More wise words, more gems of wisdom. He who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. A calm spirit. Don't you just feel your blood pressure going down when you read those words? In verse 28, even a fool is counted wise when he holds his peace. When he shuts his lips, he is considered perceptive. Now, I thought my grandmother came up with that basic statement. But I think Solomon beat her by 3,000 years, give or take. She used to say something like that. Something like, better to keep your mouth shut and be thought a fool than open it and remove all doubt. Something like that. But I guess I know where she got it. And then Proverbs 20, here's my personal favorite in terms of just taking the better path. Proverbs 20 and verse 3, it is honorable for a man to stop striving, since any fool can start a quarrel. That's pretty direct. That's pretty direct. Does a grateful person go around looking for fights? I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, there are a lot more where these came from, but why hand them all to you free of charge? Homework. Dig up some more words of wisdom and gratitude in your studies, and know that there's a point to it all. Being of a grateful outlook will give you even more to be grateful about. Another thought in a sermon on gratitude. This may at first glance seem to be the same, but it's not. Expressing our gratitude. Expressing our gratitude. Have you ever had somebody tell you something that you really appreciated, and they started by saying, I was thinking this the other day, but then I thought, if I don't tell him or if I don't tell her, they'll never know what I was thinking about. And that's true. It's not the same thing as just being a grateful person. That's important and clearly where we need to start. And I thank Mr. Horchak for so clearly modeling that approach in his letter to the ministry and in this week's In Accord. Really appreciated that. So what's the difference? What is there that is added to being a grateful person and expressing it? Turn to Luke chapter 17. And an example from Jesus Christ's ministry can tell us what the difference is. Luke 17, beginning in verse 11. Now it happened as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers, who stood socially distanced. Okay, that's not what it says, but I thought I'd make this a really updated sermon. They stood afar off. And they lifted up their voices and said, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. So when he saw them, he said to them, go show yourselves to the priests. And so it was that as they went, they were cleansed. They began looking at each other and look at what? Look at your hands. Look at your arms. And they began to realize they were all healed. Now, I would ask you to think about something. Do you think that they all were grateful inside that this had happened? I would guess they were. I mean, after all, if you've done any research at all or have any idea of what it was like to be a leper back at that time, in that day and in that age, it was horrible. If you've seen the classic 1959 movie Ben-Hur, for example, you may have some idea. In that movie, the main protagonist, mother and sister, eventually become lepers. Now, because it's set in the time of Jesus Christ, at the time of his death, the story goes that they are miraculously cleansed. But it depicts pretty well what it was like for lepers living back in that time. They were ostracized. They were pushed to the edges of society. They were feared. They were shunned. People wished they would just go away somewhere, out of sight, and, you know, just be gone. So I'm guessing that all 10 of these people, all 10 men, were grateful and thankful. How many of them took the trouble to go back and to say thank you? You know the story. One leper. One of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned and with a loud voice glorified God and fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. So Jesus answered and said, "Were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner?" You know what that makes me ask? What were the other 9? Why did Jesus stress the fact that only one came back, but he specifically said, why nobody else? Why only this foreigner? That makes me wonder if the other 9 were Jewish. It wouldn't be the first time that Jesus told a story that showed good qualities of Gentiles in a Jewish audience, and it didn't go over well. For those 10 to receive healing, surely they were all very grateful, at least in their minds. But how many came back to actually tell Jesus Christ? Only one. And in a way that must have been tough for most of Jesus' audiences to accept, that one was not even a Jew. He was a Samaritan, a group also looked down on by the Jews of the day. Not quite to the extent they looked down on lepers, but close enough. And Christ called attention to this man's grateful character. What did that require of him to come back and actually show gratitude? Well, it took humility. It took the willingness to admit that he had a serious health need and that Jesus Christ had met that need by a supernatural healing. And if you look at the context, just before Jesus tells this story, look at what he has this discussion with his apostles, the disciples, beginning in verse 5. And the apostle said to the Lord, "Increase our faith." So the Lord said, "If you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, 'Be pulled up by the roots and be planted in the sea,' and it would obey you. And which of you, having a servant plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, 'Come at once and sit down to eat'? But won't he rather say to him, 'Prepare something for my supper. Gird yourself and serve me till I have eaten and drunk, and afterwards you can eat and drink.' Does he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I think not. So likewise you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, say, 'We're unprofitable servants. We have done what it was our duty to do.'" And then follows the story of the 10 lepers that were healed. Sometimes, brethren, it takes going above and beyond to show a godly heart. The Roman centurion in Matthew 8 was a similar story. A man of some authority. Remember in Matthew chapter 8. Also, of course, in this case, a Gentile. A Roman. Matthew 8 verse 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him pleading with him, saying, "Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented." Jesus said, "I'll come and heal him." The centurion answered and said, "Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof. Only speak a word and my servant will be healed. I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes. To another, 'Come,' and he comes. To my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Jesus heard that, he marveled and said to those who followed, "Assuredly, I say to you, I have not seen faith, such great faith, not even in Israel." Many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour. Gratitude. Gratitude. The centurion expressed his faith and his gratitude for the fact that Christ's power was far greater than his own. He said, I know the principle. I know how it works when you have authority. I can tell servants and soldiers to do this, but you can just say, let him be healed. You don't even have to come by my house. That's remarkable. Gratitude and humility. They go hand in hand. We need those qualities in times like these. Of course, when we do express gratitude, we must mean it. And there's plenty more in Jesus' words about that. Just in the Sermon on the Mount, you read the concept in chapter 17 of fruits and trees. A good tree is known by the good fruit. A bad tree is known by the bad fruit. They have to go together. Speaking of which, I'll give you one last thought today on gratitude. Putting it all together. Let's just call it putting it all together. What does it all add up to? Well, brethren, really, it's rather simple. What do God's holy days, whether weekly like today or annual like tomorrow, really mean to us? They're holy time. They're time that God has put his presence in. In a way that's a little hard to grasp in some ways, except we can just go back and reread the creation account in Genesis 1 and 2 and find out that there was a day that was made special because God treated it a certain way. He's the one who decides what's holy and what is not. Holy and profane, Isaiah talks about the difference. The connection ought to be clear for us as well. You know, I had to ask myself when I got to thinking and started stepping all over my lower lip this past week and thinking, where was I last year for Pentecost? You know, Jerusalem! Where am I going to be this year? Family room! Okay, my family room's comfortable. I'm grateful for a pleasant place to live and a rather sweet-natured person who shares the residence with me. As long as I remember to show gratitude properly, it makes things a little better always, too. But did I really expect to be in Jerusalem every year for Pentecost? You know, I really didn't think that I should be looking at my wife long about April and say, you know, honey, we need to book our flight reservations for Jerusalem for Pentecost. We haven't done that yet. And no. I didn't expect that to happen. But I will admit, I didn't figure on a year ago being plunked down in front of my television, watching my Roku account as the headquarters webcast comes on for the one service for Pentecost. Didn't expect that either. Then I asked myself a question. I said, Johnson, does that change anything about what Pentecost is all about? And the answer is, dummy, no. That's what I said to myself. No, it doesn't change anything about what the day is about. God has given us an incredible blessing to know his plan. Nothing can change or stop or alter that plan. The physical is, after all, only temporary. Last week I read in the sermons from 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And the more I thought about it, putting this together last night, after listening to Mr. Horchak's In Accord, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, I need to read it again this week. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 15. Paul writes, for all things are for your sakes, that grace, having spread through the many, may cause thanksgiving to abound to the glory of God. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing. Let's put it into the context of where we are today. Even though we're dealing with this, you know, difficult condition, this unexpected pause button on the entire world called COVID-19, does it change anything? Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. Several of you have commented to me and to my wife that if we don't take advantage of the time we've been given to dig deeper into God's Word and to dig deeper into our own characters and ask, what more can I learn yet? What do I yet need to see about myself? One person one person telling me that somebody else told her, the statement was, it's like we've been given an extended period of Passover preparation this year. Well, that's a pretty good way to put it. Pretty good way to put it. The inward man is being renewed day by day. Saw a couple of references somebody put on social media. Well, I'm back to binge watching FI online. Well, that's okay. That's allowed. For our light affliction, someone else in this congregation, I won't say who and embarrass anybody. Someone else said, and more than one, in fact, said, if we can't learn how to deal with something like this, how do we ever expect to get through what biblical prophecy tells us lies in the future? That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. You know, brethren, people have gone through far worse things for far more extended periods of time. Do a little reading on the Holocaust. Read Anne Frank's diary, if you can stand it. And understand that sometimes people go through things for years and years and years that permanently change them. We've been dealing with this for about 3 months. And we are beginning to see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. We don't yet know what lies down the road in detail, but we are beginning to see a little bit of a glimmer of hope. It goes on to say, our light affliction, but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. And verse 18 really is the capstone. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Do we realize that? Does it sink in? Our society is clearly not heading in that direction. It's moving further and faster into a materialistic direction, a confrontational direction, a divided direction, a polarized, politicized outlook. And it's not going to get any better. My wife brought to my attention a news item the other day. There are now beginning to be some serious concerns about what are called the computer-generated technologies are getting so good. You know, at first it was funny when they would make a person's lips move from a news clip and make it look like they said something they didn't really say. And ha ha ha, that's funny. They have a name for it. It's called deep fakes. And they're getting so good that the fear is that it will be at some point impossible to tell the difference. Can you imagine what damage that can do? If we don't have our roots firmly grounded in God's way of life, we could be shaken too. Which is what it says in Matthew 24. If it were possible, they would deceive the very elect. We have our part to play in making sure it's not possible. Don't we? We are called to go a different way. The physical we see now is not what will last. Here's where we need to heed the words of a man who had it all on a physical and material level. Solomon wrote nearly 3,000 years ago in the book of Ecclesiastes in the 3rd chapter, something to give us material to mull over in our minds, to ponder, to think deeply about. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 9. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. Do you understand what it will be like to actually live forever? I can't really quite wrap my mind around it. They tell us the sun will burn out in X number of, what is it, million years, billion years? I hope it's a billion, so we have a little more time. Million or billion, what difference does it make to us in this form? And million or billion, what difference will it make to us in spirit form? But for a totally different reason. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. And also that every man should eat and drink, enjoy the good of all his labor, that is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. If you have in your mind the backdrop of what Solomon's experiment was all about, and then put these words into play, wow, they have a lot of meaning. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before Him. That which is has already been, and that which is to be, what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. Or some translations say, God seeks an account of what is pursued. God seeks an account of what is pursued. That brings us back pretty much full circle today. What is it that you and I are pursuing? Why is it that we're all so happy to be back together again, even if we have to give air hugs from 6 feet away? The time will come when those will come back too. I mean, the real thing. It will come. As the old saying is, this too shall pass. I don't know exactly how or when or in what manner. But one day there will come a day when you and I will be visiting a church and we'll be saying, remember 2020? Remember that coronavirus thing? Boy, that thing, it just felt like it was going to last forever. Aren't you glad we made it through that okay? It'll come. It'll come. Does a worldwide pandemic affect God? Are God and Jesus Christ socially distanced in the third heaven? Does it change any of His plan and purpose for our lives? Which makes more sense? The world's way of confrontation and demanding rights? Or the way of asking God humbly, what are my responsibilities before You? What do You expect of me? It ought to be crystal clear to us what the answer is. It will be clear if we are determined, brethren, to be grateful now for His purpose in our lives, thankful to Him that it will be offered to all human beings in their time, which is also part of the meaning of the holy days that we keep every year. So, we are returning to services. after what seems like a long time. I agree. March 7th, we walked out of here with no idea that things would be different a week later. I have a communication I was getting, I looked at before putting the sermon together. It was written from Texas to all of us in the ministry on Thursday, March the 12th. And it referenced what was beginning to happen in the world. Well, not beginning, it was happening. And the comment was made, we certainly hope and pray this will not affect our ability to meet together on God's Sabbaths, to keep the Passover together, to keep the days of unleavened bread together. That was March 12th. On March 13th, the decision was made, we're going to cancel services for the time being. I remember hearing that one of the other bodies, the Churches of God, had canceled for 2 weeks. And I thought, well, I wonder if we'll cancel for 2 weeks, maybe three, what will we do? Today is the 9th webcast that we've done locally in this manner. And the first time that there have been more than 5 people here when we did it. Oh, we had 6 here on the Passover. But, you know, huge increase. 20% more than the other times. But we cannot, no human can alter God's purpose. It will be clear to us what God's plan is and what the right way to go is if we're grateful and thankful. We're returning to services. Let's be grateful for that. Let's express that gratitude to God, to each other. And I will add my personal thank you today to my friend Doug Horchak, whether he ever knows about it or not, for exemplifying it so well for all of us these last few days. Happy Sabbath, brethren. Welcome home.